Good. Everything is now normal. This morning session, Living as Christians in a Time of Fear. You just never know what, sorry, I should say, I never know when I'm preparing a sermon where things are going to go. And I started off with this thought, and I thought, yep, that's good. This is important for now. Got a definition of fear off Wikipedia. Fear is a feeling induced by perceived danger or threat that occurs in certain types of organisms, which causes a change in metabolic and organ functions and ultimately a change in behavior, such as fleeing, hiding, or freezing. Fear in human beings may occur in response to a specific stimulus occurring in the present or in anticipation or expectation of a future threat. So if you didn't know what fear was, you do now. And I thought, here's the key verse that we need to study for this, I thought. There is no fear in love, for perfect love drives out fear. 1 John 4:18. Then a thought came into my head. Should Christians be actively opposing the people and actions that cause fear? We're living in a world where we see the word fear and terror on our tellies all the time. Should Christians be actively opposing the people and actions that cause the fear? There's two issues with this. First is that Jesus didn't. He just simply didn't. He lived in a world where he lived in a place that was under Roman occupation. It was an absolutely brutal occupation. There were all sorts of things going on in that society that we would say, well, something must be done about this, including slavery, horrendous forms of execution and punishment, and a number of other things. And Jesus didn't get involved in criticizing the Romans or criticizing the Herodian government. He was a bit personally rude about Herod. But he didn't criticise the way things were organised. He had a completely different agenda. So I'm not happy with that, actually. I'd liked him to have been a bit more active and saying, you know, leading the Judean Popular Front or whatever it was, and saying, down with the Romans, and what have the Romans ever done for us, and stuff like that. But it didn't happen. The second thing is that there must be considerable disagreement among people who, when you're trying to identify who are the people and the actions that cause the fear. If you talk about terrorism today and you went into a group of people and you say, well, who's causing the fear? Some people would say, well, it's the terrorists. Of course, it's those awful Islamic people. And I'm seeing tons of stuff on Facebook from Christians saying exactly that. Other people would say, well, there may be reasons why they're doing that. And that may, those reasons may actually have something to do with Western countries and the way they've been behaving. And that's something we're going to be looking at. Anyway, all that led me to a particular place in my preparation where something really weird happened, and this is the weird thing. 80s pop music. Does that feel like a cognitive dissonance situation? No. What? Not pop. Well, I've got news for you, sister. What do you think when you hear the words 80s pop music? Sorry?
Nightclubs and dancing.
Nightclubs and dancing, yeah. I think blokes with curly hair, I don't know why. But no. Sorry? Songs with poor words repeated all over again. Do you think protest music?
No.
No. Okay, well, we're going to listen to a piece of 80s pop now, which is... Sorry? No, it's not Depeche Mode. No. It's Jackson Brown. It's a song called Lives in the Balance. And I'm going to put the words up, and I need to just warn you about one thing. There's a couple of instrumental passages in the song, one in the middle and one at the end, and I put images in so that you don't get bored during the instrumental bits. I chose the images. Obviously, when I put images there, I do it for a purpose. It's, you know, to create some kind of an emotional reaction in you lot. And I don't apologise for that, but, you know, I just admit that I've actually done that, so you'll see them when they come along. And the images are not 1986, which is when this song was released. The images are very, very current. And then we'll, when we've done that, rather than talking about the Bible, we're going to do an exegesis of Jackson Brown's lyrics. And it's going to be fun. It's going to be interesting. And I suspect that there is going to be some fairly serious disagreement. But I could be wrong. Hit it. Nothing yet. That sounds promising. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I've been waiting for something to happen, for a week or a month or a year, with the blood in the ink of the headlines and the sound of the crowd in my ear. You might ask what it takes to remember when you know that you've seen it before, where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. And there's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again: how the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are lives in the balance.
Just a couple of interesting things. That was 1986, when nobody did protest music. And these are a couple of comments that music critics made of the album. Brown shouldn't be doing this. He's a pop star. Who's stretching his audience and endangering his market share merely by making such a statement in 1986. And the second one, this is a bit wordy. If Brown sounded more involved in his music than he had in some time, the specificity of his approach inevitably limited its appeal and its long-term significance. They're saying that he's getting a bit more passionate than we've expected him to be in the past with this album. But the fact that he's going down this political way, this political road, inevitably means that it's the album's appeal will be limited and its long-term significance will be limited. History may find that interesting. Like I said, we're going to go through some of that, and what I want to do is to remember to ask that question: should we be involved in this stuff? Should we as Christians actually be involved in this stuff or not? Take it from that angle. I hope this is going to work. Be nice to me, you know, say things. Where a government lies to a people and a country is drifting to war. Now, Jackson Brown was writing 15 years before 9/11. It was South American stuff, exactly, yeah. You notice the song had a very South American flavour to it, and it had pan pipes and things like that. That's why he was talking about the time of the Contras in Nicaragua, where the American government... Sandinistas were in charge of Nicaragua at the time, yes. The Contras were trying to get them thrown out, and the Americans were supporting the Contras. It was, I mean, that's an indication of the whole situation there, is that Congress said, we are not going to support the Contras. The government said, yes, we are, and they organized what is called the Iran-Contra deal, which you may have heard of, which was a deal that, using Israel as an intermediary, they sold weapons to Iran and then used the money to fund the Contras. And when Congress found out about this, there were a whole load of court cases. A government lies to a people. They said, we're not doing it. Reagan, yeah. So governments do lie to their people. We know that. And 15 years later, after 9/11, of course, there was the American decision to go to war, two wars, one in Afghanistan, but the more importantly, in Iraq, in terms of lies, of saying, well, we know that there are weapons of mass destruction there. We just know it. We've got all the evidence. When there weren't, and also that there were strong links between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda when there weren't. We got lied to, the English got lied to, the Americans got lied to, everybody got lied to. These things happen, and a country is drifting to war. Any comments at this moment? Just hold on a second.
The other bit of context for 86, similar to recent times, is that that was the end of a very long credit-driven investment boom that crashed the next year.
Yep.
So it was at the height of the insanity of a long boom of everybody getting rich the easy way.
Yep.
Until they didn't. Yep. And that was infecting the whole of the way everybody thought. Everyone was too busy, making money to worry about Jackson Brown.
Yep.
I guess this is a question, because I was in 86, I was 7. For me, when 9/11 happened, when there was this kind of move towards weapons of mass destruction and reasons to go to war, it really never had any credibility. Like, I didn't ever trust the government was telling me the truth. And I was a uni student, and that was, that's what uni students do. But I'm just wondering, was that just my experience? Was it, as a culture, are we getting more sceptical and less trusting of our governments?
Yes, yes.
And what's the implication for that? Is that actually a good thing? Or does that then result in that kind of a Donald Trump anti-government? Yeah.
Yes, good question. Know. Very good questions. Yes. Being essentially optimistic, I would hope that it's going to eventually lead to politicians saying we can't carry on behaving like this. And all it's going to need is one seriously ethical prime minister who doesn't lie, and who treats the opposition with respect and does all those kind of things. And I think that everybody will start doing it very quickly, for a while, maybe. But I could just be optimistic, yeah. Jen.
Sometimes I think we think we're being sceptical, but the things that really matter are often the questions that we don't even know are there, so nobody's asking them because they're the hidden ones. I was at a social gathering and we were talking about the budget, as one does, and I said, it's interesting, there's one item that's never discussed at budget time. And everyone goes, well, what's that? Is it this or is it that? And I said, no, the obvious one, the big one. And nobody could get it. It's the military budget. Anyway, this guy sort of looks at me, turns out he's ex-military, and says, people like you are dangerous.
Yes, you are, yes.
Yeah. Now, you probably have known that for a long time, yeah. But but I thought, well, it's the violin case, yeah. That kind of, we can think we're being quite canny and knowing, but there can be a whole another layer of stuff that's underpinning what the direction that we're going that we don't even know that there's any questions to ask.
Mm. Yeah. The whole thing about money is huge. People talk about the military-industrial complex. You probably all know that America sends an absolutely incredible amount of money on defence every year, which is odd for a country that's only actually been attacked twice. I mean, mainland America. No, sorry, not even mainland America. But there is this whole infrastructure of people whose jobs are people who've got investments in arms company, the whole economy of selling arms to other countries where the import export is extremely important. It just goes on and on and on. Luca.
So I was just thinking in that context, one of the biggest lies, and picking up on your comment too, Jenny, about the things that are hidden, there's a lot of talk about, you know, the Western countries delivering aid, foreign aid, and, you know, there's arguments on either side about cutting that or expanding that, depending on which flavour if government is in. The biggest lie is the fact that, you know, the actual transfer of wealth between countries is actually the other way around.
Yes.
You know,
yeah.
Trillions of dollars flow from some of the poorest countries to the richest.
Yeah.
And the arms trade is one of the reasons why that happens.
Yeah, yeah. We can keep moving. I hope you're all right with it. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who send the guns to the wars that are fought in places where the business interest runs. We've just been talking about that. Yes, yes. Okay. Sorry?
Oil.
Oil. This is really interesting. On the radio talk shows and TV, you hear one thing again and again, how the USA stands for freedom and we come to the aid of a friend. Who are the ones that we call our friends, these governments killing their own, or the people who finally can't take any more and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone? Our friends are the people who are going to buy the goods that we produced, basically. And our enemies are those who threaten that. This last bit, he's asking a question there. Who are these ones we call our friends? Are they the governments who are killing their own people? Or are they the people who finally can't take any more and pick up a gun or a brick or a stone? Are those our friends? Are those the people who should be our friends? And this... Sorry? Go on.
Part of the way that these sort of things get sold is by identifying the bigger threat in the world. If you go back to 1986 and the Iran-Contra scandal and all of that, the Sandinistas were in Nicaragua. They'd taken over the government. They were socialists. They were allied with the Soviet Union. To America, the biggest threat in the world was communism. The Soviet communism. So in addressing the biggest threat, it was necessary for them to arm a resistance movement to that government. So when you look at this line here, there'd be many people who would have said, oh, those Contras, they're the freedom fighters. And that's how marketed.
Yes,
they were marketed as the freedom fighters that were opposing the evil government. And America was supporting those.
Yeah.
So it all comes down to, in order to get the people behind what a powerful government wants to do in terms of exerting force in the world, it comes down to identifying a big threat. Is communism the most dangerous thing in the world? Islam the biggest threat? And that's the one nowadays that, that is being used to sell any expenditure in military, both domestically and to export, is there's this big threat. So anything that we can say that we feel may be tied to that in any way, that we choose to for our own whatever purposes, then it becomes very easy to sell that we need to attack that.
Let me just keep going and hang on to that thought. What do Christians do? Sorry?
With that, in that it's incredibly binary.
Yes.
You know, that binary approach is incredibly problematic. And if you look at any kind of post-war governments, generally they're power sharing between very fractured, very different political, and that's what it takes to rule a country.
Yes.
It takes Pauline Hanson and it takes Nick Xenophon. It takes a very diverse, non-binary approach.
Yes. And I certainly wouldn't say, I would say that the governments or the people who can't take any more and are picking up the guns, yes, they're both contributing, obviously, to the violence. And again, the question is, well, how should Christians behave at that moment? Back to advertising. They sell us the president the same way they sell us our clothes and our cars. They sell us everything from youth to religion the same time they sell us our wars. Nothing's changed. No. They do. They sell us our wars. Sorry, we're running out of time here. I want to know who the men in the shadows are. I want to hear somebody asking them why. They can be counted on to tell us who our enemies are, but they're never the ones to fight or to die. I think this is such an important point, which is very... There is, in these days, exactly your experience, Jenny. You are not allowed to criticise the military. You are not allowed to criticise soldiers, certainly. And returned servicemen are on a level where nothing can be said against them. And unfortunately, effectively, it's become a situation where nothing can be said against the reason that they went there in the first place. There's been a study done on the most trusted people in the community, and it's nurses. The least trusted people in the community are politicians. Politicians are the only people who decide whether we are going to war or not. There's not a lot of hands going up, Jen.
Do you think that's a contemporary type thing? I'm thinking back to the men who returned from the First World War and the Second World
War. You
are?
Sorry, go on.
Did that come out wrong?
you just look much too young, but carry on.
Well, you often see them being interviewed, and a lot of them have died by now, but you know, you're looking at historical interviews that they did with these men, and there's no pride in what they did. There's no pride in their governments for sending them there. Their biggest thing is they are anti-war, and yet at the moment this almost deification of returned servicemen and the glory of warfare, it's almost like it's going back several centuries to the Crusades or something like that. I'm just wondering if this is a contemporary movement that has come since perhaps, I don't know, the end of Vietnam or something like that, where they were vilified. And I'm not saying that Vietnam veterans shouldn't be respected. Obviously they should, because a lot of them didn't have any choice to go. But at the same time, is this a knee-jerk reaction to the way they were treated, and we now put our ex-servicemen on some sort of pedestal? And I'm not saying... You know, they are really just the cannon fodder, and they always have been. But it took World War I and World War II for those men who came back to say, we were cannon fodder and there's no glory in this.
Claire?
One of my concerns with all these lyrics is the use of they. They. There's some faceless other who we can use as our scapegoat for saying someone else is doing these terrible things to us. poor victim us that are caught up into the military-industrial complex who do not have an agency within this. And I think one of the profoundest things about the way Jesus lived was there was no them. It was only us. There was only us all the time. And when he spoke to the Pharisees, they were human beings who were equals with him. When he spoke to the poor, when he spoke to the rich. And I think that's a real hard place to be in when we step into an activist world, is to remember always that there's no them in it.
Good. Karen? Oh, John? Hang on a second.
Just quickly. But he did say, woe to you, scribes and Pharisees.
Yeah, he called them hypocrites. That way. Karen, please.
We were being assailed with the information. So I was 20-something. I had a newborn child in that time. And I was already a Jackson Browne fan before he wrote this song. So this became a hymn of my life. It's not just a song to me. We were being assailed with that there was a they and a them, and they were the baddies, and this is why our Western countries were doing all these things that were questionable. They knew they were questionable, but we had to fight the they. And in this song, Jackson Browne turns it around to say that the they, the them, the possible enemy, is not who.
Yep.
But I also agree with what she said about Jesus. But I just wanted to say that the words were chosen because of using the vernacular of the time that was using how we were being sold, the things that were happening in the world. The reason, I just want also want like to say, the reason this moves me so much is that I had a one-year-old, my firstborn one-year-old, and at the time of in history that this song was written, I was sure things would get better. That baby is now about to have her second baby, and I am sure things will not get better.
I might be getting ahead of you, Peter, with this, but some of you might have met me with my friend Jose from El Salvador, yeah. And he was a leader of the rebels in El Salvador. He was the top man in the country and a leader of the rebels, but he became a Christian as part of that journey. And then in Australia, many years later, was able to look back and recall that his girlfriend in El Salvador had said to him that by the time you win this fight, you will be as bad as they are. And Jose left his country with bullets whistling around his ears, with the past effects of torture, and began a new life here. And his life doesn't include revenge.
Okay, we'll leave it there, I think. We're past time. Fleur, over to you. I'm not going to pull it together. I'll pull it together. That's the full verse that I talked about earlier. It's a bit of a difficult one. There is no fear in love, for perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. That last sentence, you could basically spend a year trying to work out really what's going on there. It's a difficult one. Perfect love drives out fear, I think he's right. This is another verse from 1 John. We're going to have to do a series on 1 John. I've just been reading it, getting ready for this. It's absolutely brilliant. It is great. For the love of God is this, that we obey his commands, and his commands are not burdensome. Whatever is born of God conquers the world. This is the victory that conquers the world, our trust. It is our trust in God, I believe, that will enable us to overcome this. But it still leaves the question, should Christians be actively opposing the people and actions that cause the fear, without defining who they are, because it's probably everybody, including us. Should we be actively opposing it, or should it just be a matter of prayer and trust? And I don't know the answer to that.